Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and...
And Joshua Hughes. Hello, Podcat fans.
So, I think it's probably worth our time just to explain what this podcast is all about, Josh.
Yeah, so Mike and I were members of a research network called TTAC21, or to give it its full title, Technology, Terrorism and Armed Conflict in the 21st Century. In that research network, we and a bunch of other fantastic people... looked at issues of technology, terrorism, armed conflict in the recent past and near future through lenses of history, law, literature, philosophy, English, various wonderful subjects that were absolutely fascinating. Took us on wonderful conceptual, intellectual journeys, I guess. But Mike and myself have been discussing recently about interests beyond. The prism of terrorism and armed conflict, and we thought that this In The Zone podcast would be a good way to explore stuff that doesn't necessarily involve people killing each other.
Yeah, so it's just taking on a bit of everything that we're interested in, really, and putting it out there in podcast format.
Yeah.
So we should probably say a little bit about ourselves first. So I'll go first. So my name's Mike Ryder. My website is mjryder.net, if you're interested. I'm a final year PhD student in the English Literature Department, but my research mainly focuses on philosophy and critical theory linking to biopolitics and the Vietnam War. Josh, how about you?
So I'm also a final year PhD student. I'm from the Law Department. My work looks at the international law issues of weapon systems controlled by artificial intelligence. Or aka killer robots. So I look at what autonomy is, how autonomy manifests in machines and in weapons particularly, what we can learn about previous or historical uses of weapons with autonomy, and also how law governs and regulates the use of fully autonomous weapon systems, and then after that, what happens or who can be held accountable if things go wrong, or when things go wrong, I probably should say. Yeah, so that's my project, and I'll hand back to Mike to explain what we're going to talk about today.
Right, so for our first episode, we thought we'd look at autonomy, which is something that sort of crops up in both of our research areas, really. But in particular, we're quite interested in autonomous cars, as this is something that's been in the news quite a lot recently, especially with various incidents in the press of people crashing their Teslas. While not necessarily even sitting in the driving seats. So to kick off then, Josh, I think you said you had some levels of autonomy from your angle.
Yeah, so the Society of Automotive Engineers over in America has come up with this idea of a framework for looking at different levels of autonomous car or autonomous vehicle. So they look at autonomy in five different levels. The first level being sort of a single aspect is automated. So an example of that is cruise control, or maybe some cars now have, when it starts to rain, the window wipers will come on automatically. So for them, that would be a first level of autonomy. The second level of autonomy would be where there's two or more elements are automated. So quite a lot of cars now have, or new cars now have, self-parking kind of capabilities. So you kind of pull up to a space and a camera can see the space and you position the car and kind of the machine does itself.
I was just going to ask, so does that mean then that most cars today have got at least level two autonomy, would we say?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it depends on what car it is, because probably a cheap new car isn't going to have this sort of technology, but more expensive cars and more advanced cars will. But still, I think probably all new cars that have, you know, at least automatic window wipers or cruise control, we could say have some level of autonomy.
Well, just because I was just wondering, because you said two or more.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you've got the windscreen wipers and maybe the auto headlights, does that then automatically put you in the second category?
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
Even if you don't have the fancy parking mechanisms and the cameras.
Yeah. So as we can see, kind of the levels of this is again, well, it's not again. This is where this kind of schema that the Society of Automotive Engineers kind of starts to break down a bit. Because when we think about autonomous cars, we think about highly technical objects and machines doing quite intelligent things, but actually we can think of even level two could just be a car that have automatic windscreen wipers and automatic headlights that come on in the dark and then when it rains. So what that, I guess what that tells is that autonomy, although we think of it as being high tech thing, it can actually be quite low tech. It's really just the automation of an action that would normally be done by a human being, and delegation from a human being or an engineer in this case to a machine to perform a task.
Yeah, so I mean, that's quite interesting, because one of the things that always strikes me and it always annoys me as a road user is that this leads to a lot of people becoming quite lazy, I find, especially whenever you've sort of drive into a tunnel. Obviously, you'll see all the people with the automated headlights, because all the lights come on as soon as they enter and then they all go off as soon as they leave.
Yeah.
But then what happens, though, is when you get to sort of, maybe you're driving just down the road at dusk time, for example, where it's not quite dark enough to trigger the headlights, but they should have their lights on. You'll see so many people that don't ever put their lights on because they're waiting for their car to automatically...
Absolutely, yeah. And it's really annoying.
It's really annoying.
But there's also... Obviously, that's a problem where people have become too used to autonomy.
Yeah.
And there's also, I think, problems that I find really annoying where people haven't got used to the fact that they haven't got autonomy. They haven't got used to being human. And I think a big example of this is people who leave their full beam headlights on in the dark when you're coming the other way and you're startled and blinded by their lights.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one as well, because sometimes you wonder if that's just them being stupid. Or is it just that they think that the car should be doing it for them?
Yeah, I think probably a lot of people forget this type of thing and you know, forget to turn them off. And so this is an area where automation would be really useful, because automation would obviously do it for you, but a lot of people who just forget to turn them off they haven't got any automation to rely on, so it just causes problems.
So the problem here is that they haven't got automation, not that they do have automation.
Yeah, that was kind of the line I was thinking, yeah.
So, okay then, so what about the third level of autonomy?
So level three is where elements of driving in the critical functions are automated. And critical functions is a concept that goes beyond just autonomous vehicles. It's also present when we talk about autonomous weapon systems. And critical functions are those which are key to the functioning of the system. So when we talk about vehicles, we talk about a vehicle being able to do everything related to driving in a certain situation. When we talk about weapons, we talk about selection and engagement of targets, but we're going to leave kind of the war-y stuff for another
now.
Time. But yeah, so level three is when the critical functions of driving are automated. And then we can go on to level four, which kind of goes beyond critical functions to full automation, but only in certain environments. These are controlled environments. So, for example, a university or technology kind of campus where the roads on the campus, kind of in a self-contained kind of little bubble, can be adapted so that the self-driving car can understand all of the road signs, all of the speed limits, everything that's kind of it could encounter. The vehicle can understand everything that's in this little self-contained bubble.
I'm just trying to think. Wasn't there something about an airport with some cars that work a little bit like that?
Yeah, so there's quite a few little spaces with things like this. I think there's some airport transport's a good example, because the shuttle between terminals or between the car park is only going to go on certain roads. So you could quite relatively easily, should I say, automate everything within every function in a self-contained little area of transport.
And does this also apply to rail transport,
I was thinking this because I was when I was writing this list down in my notes for this, I was thinking of the DLR.
I'm thinking of DLR now, yeah.
Where you can sit at the front and pretend to be the driver. But obviously the problem with the DLR is that, or other type of monorail or rail, is that there's... because it's not got very much freedom in what it does. So really, like the DLR example, all it can do is automate stopping and opening doors and accelerating. And I suppose you could think of that as an autonomous vehicle, just because it can do it all on its own. But I think there's kind of a qualitative difference between the restriction on its behaviour and of the DLR and only being able to do certain tasks. Compared with an autonomous vehicle, which, okay, there are still only certain tasks it can do. It can only accelerate, brake, turn left and right, and go in reverse. But kind of its environment is much freer,
Yeah, I'm just thinking then, I'm thinking like a Lyft. I mean, we wouldn't call a Lyft an autonomous vehicle, would we?
Yeah.
But I suppose a DLR would be closer to that then than maybe an autonomous car because it can't go outside the realms of its sort of lift shaft.
Yeah, and I think this again, this is another area where levels of autonomy ideas start to kind of be a bit, they're a bit too brittle to function, I think, because in autonomous weapons, we can also think about levels of autonomy, but in terms of human-controlled weapons to automatic, to automated, to autonomous, but there are lots of kind of specific technologies that are maybe in between, or some ways are autonomous and some ways are automatic, and so kind of defy classification in a way. I mean, a good example is the sensor-fused weapon in weapons, but again, we'll come back to cars, and I think kind of these level four cars, where they're autonomous in a closed environment, I think we could think, well, obviously we can think of them as autonomous because they function freely in an environment, but because of that, because that environment is closed, it's more towards automation. It's more doing a task that a human has laid out rather than you know, interacting with its environment and making decisions itself.
Yeah, I'm just wondering then, are these types of automated cars more like the DLR example, but just without a track, so it's like an invisible track, if you will?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I think that's probably a good comparison, that, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, it does the DLR task of getting you from one place to another in a relatively small area, or the tube task, or the public transport task, as we can talk about. But obviously, with it just being a car, it's more flexible in terms of passengers and how fast it can go and how regular it can be, I guess.
I'm just thinking of the other variable. I suppose it must encounter far more variables than the DLR, just because you've got sort of members of the public, you've got pedestrians, you've got unexpected things that might cross the road, because there's no clear marking of the rails, as it were, that it's driving on. Things become a little bit more complicated, but still it's restricted in the scope of how far it can operate.
Mm. Yeah, I think the notions of pedestrians and other, you know, vehicles interacting with it in this closed environment, kind of we can see that's a greater level of sophistication than we would think of as the DLR or you know, a monorail type of thing. So beyond level four comes to level five, which is fully autonomous in all situations. So we can think of a car driving on ordinary streets, transitioning from the motorway to a country lane to inner city driving and all that kind of thing. So in that way, we can think of it as fully autonomous. And I think this sort of scheme is good because it gives people a good idea of what's going on and how they can understand these types of vehicles. But as I've alluded to a couple of times, it's a bit too brittle, I think, for really understanding these sorts of systems. And that's why I quite like Paul Charest's understanding of autonomy in machine, or machine autonomy, should I say. Obviously, it's based, not obviously, but it is based in weapon systems. That's obviously my background. But the way Charest thinks about autonomy in machines is along three different dimensions. So there's the task that a machine can be asked to do. There's a level of sophistication that the machine has. And then there's the human-machine relationship. And moving along each dimension, if we move further along each dimension, we can think of as a machine as being more autonomous. So if the tasks are more complicated, we can think of it being more autonomous. If the system's more sophisticated than another system, we can think of it being more autonomous. And if the human-machine relationship is more distant, then we can think of it as being more autonomous. So obviously, if we hark back to the five levels of autonomous vehicles, like level two, where there's two or more elements that are automated. So self-parking is a good example. It's a single task, although there are many subtasks within that. Its level of sophistication is high tech. I think you can call it high tech for today, but in comparison to a fully autonomous vehicle, it's quite low. And the human machine relationship is quite close, because a person has to instigate self-parking at that moment and keeps watch and observes the vehicle performing its task. So it's quite a close relationship, particularly in comparison to a fully autonomous vehicle that's traveling on a motorway and then coming off the motorway, going into a city, and then maybe onto a country lane, where that's several different tasks. It's got to change lanes on the motorway, take into account speed restrictions, speed limits, other road users, particularly when it comes into any city driving, there might be cyclists. And if it goes into country lane driving, that'd be horses or other types of.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite interesting because I was thinking about the motorway example, and in a way, I think motorways are almost the easiest thing to automate from a transportation point of view, because for the most part, you're on one side of the road, your traffic's all going in the same direction. So the only variable really is the lane and the speed.
Yeah.
Whereas when you get into country roads, you've got the road direction, you've got people coming out from left, right and centre, you've got obstacles, you've got potholes, you've got...
Yeah, and you've got Freddy the Farmer taking his tractor around the bend with a bunch of hay bales and going 3 miles per hour. But yeah, as you say, kind of the motorway is one of the easiest examples to automate. And that's kind of why Tesla have become quite, or managed to get quite advanced in that kind of area. But we'll come to that in a moment. Going back to Share's kind of three dimensions, your fully autonomous vehicle is obviously highly much more sophisticated than kind of a level two vehicle that's doing self-parking, because it requires much more technological capability to perform all of those tasks. I mean, it's not just self-parking, it's the driving on various road types, as we've alluded to, but it's also like emergency braking in a city. And, situations whereby you might want a human being, normally you would want a human being to be taking, quite a significant degree of care over what's happening, but the machine is doing it. And so that requires a high level of sophistication. And the human-machine relationship might be quite low in the case of fully autonomous cars, because the human might not even be able to kind of pull an emergency stop button or stop the car or control it in any way. I mean, you can see in Google cars at the moment, the only input that a human can have really is giving it a destination and an emergency stop button. That's at least in the cars that are on Google's campus.
Yeah.
So that the human-machine relationship can be quite distant in that the human really has no control, or might not have, or no or very little control over how the system works, other than giving it a destination. And I mean, in kind of artist's impression mock-ups of what an autonomous vehicle might look like, it's often four seats all facing each other and four friends having, drinks and chatting to each other and letting the machine do its job and take them wherever they're going and not really paying much attention to the road or to their environment, really.
I mean, okay, right. So I've got a question for you, and I didn't pre-warn you about this, so this is going to be a risk. So when it comes to autonomy in cars, when you define the sort of the fully autonomous car, there is that in terms of each individual car would be individually autonomous, or how does that sit in relation to say a network of cars? Because I'm thinking, for example, if Google had a fleet of cars, for example, that was all filling up a motorway or whatever, then you've got there'll be some sort of hive mind control overseeing all of the cars in relationship to each other. So that to me seems slightly different to having 100 different cars that are all completely separate without any interrelation between them. So the type of autonomy seems slightly different to me.
Yeah, and actually I was thinking about this myself.
Oh, really?
After we discussed doing this as a podcast, I was thinking about this the other day. And I think actually that kind of hive mind idea might even be like level six.
Right.
Because it's great to have a fully autonomous vehicle that can understand it or comprehend its environment. I shouldn't say understand, because understanding is a human trait. But comprehend its environment and make calculations and deal with unexpected things that might crop up. And that's great. But what's even better is having the vehicles be able to communicate with one another.
Mm.
And a great example I find is if you pull up at traffic lights in a queue of traffic, as soon as the light goes green, the first car goes, and then the second car doesn't react to the light going green, it reacts to the first car going, and so on and so forth back through, the third, fourth, fifth, however many people are in the queue. And so what you get is maybe the tenth person in the queue is very slow, might miss the lights, basically, because they're not able to react to the green light. They have to react to car number nine.
Yeah, and they don't know that the car in front is going to move.
Exactly, yeah. But with, if you had autonomous cars that were connected in this hive mind kind of scenario, they could all react to the green light. You could have 10, 11, 12, 15 cars going through the green light rather than having to react to each other.
which is one of the benefits of your whole autonomous roadway network.
So what that means is that your journeys can be quicker and shorter in time, and also be more efficient. So it's better for the environment in that way. And also, if it's autonomous, it doesn't necessarily... Well, this is a bit of a side point, but autonomous vehicles, or most of them that are being designed, are often electric, and so that's even better for the environment. But kind of maybe this hive mind kind of idea might rely on electric vehicles, in that electric vehicles accelerate much faster than internal combustion engines.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a bit of a side point that I think is quite interesting. But kind of if we talk about this hive mind level 6 autonomy.
I'm just thinking about this hive mind because I keep saying the word interesting, but it is interesting because in a way it's less complex than the level 5.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if you know every other machine that's on the road, you've got it mapped out, it's far easier to control than... Because at the moment, we're trying to almost automate a road system that has got so many unautomated, unexpected things in it. We're almost trying to go beyond what we might want from an automated system, because ultimately, we want a load of cars that can go from A to B quickly, efficiently, and without crashing into things. But because we've got so many unexpected variables, we're having to almost surpass the threshold we need to create that system, because we've got to create something that can be used now, and we're not creating all these cars concurrently, because some cars will be on the road and some won't. So
yeah, the kind of a parallel I was just thinking of was like a football team. Kind of when you were a kid, you put together a five-a-side team of whoever was available on the park, and you didn't really know each other, you didn't really know how each other played, but you sort of muddled through, and there was always the one kid who got the ball and ran with it and tried to score. And that kind of, to me, is a bit like the cars that the fully autonomous vehicles acting alone. Whereas if you get a team that can gel together, can understand how people work, understand who's good at what, that kind of brings together more of the hive mind kind of idea, and that's always better.
Mm.
But saying it's always better, it's almost always better. You have a lot of situations whereby you want somebody to be able to do something unexpected or deal with something unexpected, and I think this links into kind of the brittleness of technology, in that lots of technologies can't really deal with unexpectedness. And so if we have kind of a hive mind, autonomous vehicles, if they're all connected and all subject to the same programming, then that makes them even more brittle and fragile, and it makes the whole system, one unexpected thing could bring the whole system down, whereas individual autonomous cars could perhaps deal with unexpected things.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm thinking of sort of Judge Dredd, and I'm thinking Demolition Man. Yeah. The futures with the autonomous cars here, and I'm just thinking about, well, you'd have to think about some sort of backup system for what happened if the network went down, what happened if a car got cut off from the network. So it would have to have some core rules to revert to. This brings me just to something I was thinking of recently, because of our conversations that we've had about drones and drone warfare. I read a book called Swarm Troopers, which is by a journalist, talking about the rise of small drones. And they were thinking about how to automate the interaction between small drones. And they were looking at birds. And this is quite interesting, because you always look at these sort of massive, the great big, what they call murmurations of starlings in the sky, where you see flocks and flocks and flocks. You can have thousands of birds all in the sky. And they're looking at a way that how would you be able to program that interaction that they have with each other. But looking on a sort of a micro level, on a sort of an individual bird basis, I mean, some scientists have decided that, or discovered that, ultimately, you can reduce that on an individual basis to a very small number of decision-making processes, which essentially relates to the distance to the birds around you. So you're within a certain distance of the bird in front, and you've just got to follow that bird in front, for example. But taken as a group, that decision process creates this whole flock mentality, but which on the surface looks quite complicated, but can be broken down to quite simple things.
Yeah, and I suppose I was thinking that's a good example, because a starling in a murmuration needs to be able to function as part of this group as a hive mind, if we're going to call it that, but also tomorrow it might need to operate on its own. And so with a fully autonomous car, it's really useful for it to operate in connection and in conjunction with other autonomous cars when it's in the city or when it's on a motorway. And obviously all those advantages that we talked about with going through traffic lights and other things. But then you're on a country road where an fully autonomous car might be on its own.
Mm.
It's actually highly, it's not very beneficial for it to be part of the hive mind. It's beneficial for it to be acting as an individual, if you will.
So they're completely two different types of intelligence we're almost describing here.
Yeah.
We're describing the group, like in the cities, so where you might have, say, sort of some central sort of AI core processing the traffic functions of all the interrelations of all the different autonomous cars. Then you've got this other scenario where you go outside the city and suddenly the car's got to be able to function independent of the sort of city hive mind, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, because I think you can kind of see some sort of emergence or divergence, really, in terms of developing autonomous vehicles, because you've got kind of Tesla on one side looking at how to automate motorway driving or highway driving, and then you've got kind of some of the Google cars that are on kind of Google campus are very small. They're surrounded by like padding and things like that, and they only go 25 miles an hour. And apparently the idea behind that is that Google will never have to deal with a fatality if their cars only go 25 miles an hour and surrounded by padding and are very safe, basically. That's the idea. And so it kind of shows this divergence between motorway driving and city driving, and perhaps fully autonomous cars of the future will have to be able to do both. That's something I was thinking about was on the motorway in a city driving connection and conjunction and action between, or cooperation, I guess is probably a good word, between autonomous cars is useful.
Mm.
And obviously on we've already mentioned that on country roads it's not perhaps so helpful. So maybe in the future there would need to be kind of some, as you mentioned, sort of some controller AI system on motorways and in the city, where an autonomous car can drive into the city or drive into the motorway and then maybe not be controlled, but be helped to be coordinated.
Mm. I'm just wondering, I'm thinking about the sort of the current day cloud computing things.
Yeah.
Like how you can donate your computer processing power to scientific projects.
Yeah.
I was just thinking maybe if it would be a case where you drive into a city, so you're driving into Manchester and into London, and then my car would sort of join a network and suddenly we'd share the computing power with your car and the car in front. And so suddenly they'd become a network wherein the performance becomes greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, so it's like a self-organising system.
Yeah.
I think that'd be... That would seem to be a good idea and solution to kind of a lot of the problems of where self-driving cars could be better in the city with cooperation and I think that would seem to be.
So essentially, what we're saying as we're coming to the end of the podcast is that in our very first ever episode, we've essentially solved the problem of autonomous cars.
I think we can say that. Yeah.
I think that's pretty good work for the day.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't think that we were going to. We thought we'd have more to solve.
Right, well, we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit inthezonepodcast.com.